Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with Stephen Schick, Artistic Director of the San Francisco Contemporary Music Players, about this weekend's celebration of California composer Lou Harrison's 100th birthday at Z-Space in San Francisco. From Cutting Ball Theater, we meet guest director Ariel Kraft and founding director, Artistic Director Rob Melrose, who shared details about Jean Racine's tragedy Phèdre, which opens this week and runs through May 21st at the Exit Theater, in a new translation by Rob. Also stopping by is San Francisco Chamber Orchestra's conductor Benjamin Simon, who discusses upcoming concerts titled The Lighter Side, featuring music from Mozart, Haydn, and P.D. Kubak, among others, and with full disclosure, myself as a co-sportscaster of the Beethoven Fifth Symphony with KDFC's Rick Malone in concerts in San Francisco, Palo Alto, and Berkeley. Plus, an interview with director Jonathan Cain about My Name is Rachel Corrie, the internationally acclaimed drama based on the writings of 23-year-old activist Rachel Corrie, who captured international attention as an activist during the Israeli-Palestinian conflict when she stood in the path of an armored bulldozer in Palestine and was fatally injured. All ahead here on Open Air. Stay with us. That's the music of Lou Harrison for violin, piano, and percussion. Varied Trio, Movement 5. The Abel Steinberg and Winant Trio performing there. Music of Lou Harrison is being celebrated by various groups around the world this year, this weekend especially so, as Lou Harrison, a centenary celebration, takes place at Z-Space on Florida Street in San Francisco. The two-day festival will begin tomorrow evening with a film on Lou's work. Events on the following day include three concerts, including the Contemporary Players' presentation of works by three young composers who won its SF Search competition, as well as works by composers Jimmy Lopez and Natasha Diels, who will discuss their work. Here to talk about the festival is Stephen Schick, percussionist, conductor, and author. For 40 years, he has championed contemporary music by commissioning or premiering more than 150 new works. He was founding percussionist of the Bang on a Can Festival, All-Stars, in 1992 to 2002, and served as artistic director of the Centre International de Percussion de Genève from 2000 to 2005. He maintains a lively schedule of conducting, including some of the great orchestras of the world, including the BBC Scottish Symphony, the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, and the Nova Chamber Ensemble, Asko Schoenberg Ensemble, among many others. Stephen is Distinguished Professor of Music at the University of California, San Diego, and was named Artistic Director of the San Francisco Contemporary Music Players in 2007. 2011, that is. Welcome, Stephen.
David, pleasure to be here.
Indeed. Well, Lou Harrison has written so much music and so well for so many people and so many instrumental combinations. I'm wondering what your personal connection to Lou is and how you first discovered his music.
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. The plethora, the extraordinary richness of the Harrison output begs the question, so which Lou Harrison do you want to present in a festival? Do you present Lou Harrison, the unabashed melodicist in a modern world? Do you present Lou Harrison, the instrument maker, the tuning geek, the world music specialist, the young firebrand progressive? And so what we really tried to do is to do a little bit of all of that to show the kaleidoscopic output and production and the musical world of this extraordinary thinker and visionary, who of course made his home in this part of the world and marked our musical life here with his output in a way that practically no other composer has done.
And I think Lou is one of those persons you can really call one of the most lovable persons you could ever imagine, and having such a gift as well.
And beloved. And so this was one of the wonderful things about working with the San Francisco Contemporary Music Players on this project, is that so many of the members of the ensemble had close personal relationships. I mean, I'm thinking in particular of David Tannenbaum and Willie Winant and Karen Gottlieb, three members of our group that worked over the course of many, many years and commissioned and premiered pieces of Harrison's. And then a number of other of us, and I'll include myself in this, who didn't know Harrison personally, but whose musical lives were enriched and really, really shaped by that music, also feel close. I feel close to Harrison even though I never worked with him.
Interesting. And as a percussionist, you must be especially drawn to his work.
Well, the percussion music is extraordinary. The music from the 30s and 40s, the work that he did with Cage and on his own, of course. And then, of course, some of the great works from the 1950s and 60s involve percussion. But I'll tell you what impresses me almost the most, and that is I always think of Lou Harrison when I walk by the Palace Hotel, because it was there that he worked as a floral designer. And in the earliest days when these progressive thoughts were just taking place and nobody knew who he was and no one was giving a big celebration of his music, he was there, cooking up these extraordinary ideas. And so I walk by that part of the city quite often, and when I look at the hotel, I think there worked a visionary, unknown to the rest of the world, and how much have we profited by that?
Right. Yeah, and we wonder who's making those same paths right now.
Exactly. That's the point.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think this is the gist of this festival. It's about Harrison, and it's the centennial celebration, as so many people are doing, especially here. But it's about a kind of cross-generational conversation. It is the imagining of who are those young composers now who are working in this kind of visionary space. And so we wanted to present Harrison is the kind of legacy composer, somebody who roots our musical language. But we also wanted to present emerging composers and mid-career composers, people like Natasha Diels, Jimmy Lopez, Gitti Razaz. These are young composers, but they are established. And then we also wish to present this very youngest generation of composers as a part of our SF Search program. We place this music together. We listen to the conversations that these composers have kind of with each other over the course of the programs. We eavesdrop on them, and I hope that we'll find that generational differences may not be so important, that there is a lot of commonality amongst the visionaries of different ages.
Interesting. So it's the prolific output that he's done. You're taking a little bit from every area of his life.
Exactly.
So tell us about the film that kicks things off on Friday evening.
Well, it's the Ava Zoltis film, Lou Harrison, A World of Music, and it'll provide a perspective, a kind of framing perspective for the piece. We'll find out about Harrison, we'll hear his music, we'll see the context, and from that we'll populate those ideas with the performances that take place on Saturday. There are actually six events, if you count all the conversations and the interactions and the encounters. So someone coming to Z-Space on Saturday at the beginning of the day for the 11 o'clock performance of the SF Search music and staying through the 7:30 evening concert will have a huge richness of input, ideas, discussions, formal and informal performances, composer talks. It'll all be there on that day.
Great. And to learn about all of the things that are happening there, the website for the San Francisco Contemporary Players is sfcmp.org. So talk us through some of those presentations that would be going on Saturday.
The first one that that will happen at 11 o'clock is the composers of the SF Search. These are young composers who submitted scores to us for fixed instrumentation, and they were chosen in a juried process. And we have three pieces, all of the composers here have contacts with Harrison in some way or another. Of course, they didn't know him, but Roger Kim, Michelle Zheng, and Benjamin Zucker. And in one way or another, through the amplitude of the musical space or the invention of notation or a particularly inventive use of instruments, these young composers echo and resonate with the Lou Harrison legacy. That's our first concert. We'll have a talk with Jimmy Lopez and Natasha Diels at 12:30 in a program we call How Music is Made, where we try to get into the process of making, of understanding the composer's mindset as he and she create the music. And then we have a concerts. And again, there's not a Lou Harrison concert per se, but we commingle Harrison with these other composers. And so we'll have the Harrison Canticle No. 3, followed by a Jimmy Lopez piano piece, another Harrison piece, the Varied Trio, of which we heard a little bit. And then Annie Gosfield, an old friend of mine from the Bang on a Can days, in her Daughters of the Industrial Revolution. That's the afternoon program. Then in the evening, kicking off the evening events at 6:30, I'm going to have a conversation with the three members who knew Lou the best, David Tannenbaum and Willie Winant and Karen Gottlieb, to get them to tell those stories.
They must have wonderful stories.
They have them, and I've heard them informally, and we're going to invite our audience to participate in that as well. And then the evening concert that consists of more Lou Harrison, Suite for Cello and Harp, and the scenes from Nek Chand, along with Gitti Razaz, a young Iranian-American composer living in New York, whose music is as rich and full of color as you could ever hope for, and Natasha Diels, another very colorful composer who is my colleague at the University of California in San Diego. In her pieces, I suppose appropriately entitled The Colors Don't Match, and that's a West Coast premiere of her work.
Fantastic. We do have an excerpt of that as well as the Lou Harrison scenes from Nek Chand.
Fantastic.
Let's hear a little bit of the Lou Harrison. Tell us about it.
Well, this is his last piece, and it was dedicated to the guitarist David Tannenbaum of our ensemble, who will play it on Saturday. So it is both authentic performance practice and a loving remembrance of that relationship that David and Lou had.
And then more with Stephen Schick. From Lou Harrison's Scenes from Nek Chand. No, do not adjust your radio, dear listener, nor did this performer perform out of tune. Stephen Schick, Lou Harrison was famous for doing alternative tunings in his work.
He was, and this is one of them. And he was both interested in the sound of the way those notes rub up against each other, but he was also an historian and a theoretician of tuning. So these weren't just randomly out-of-tune kinds of things. I was thinking as I was listening to this of a performance I did with Sarah Cahill with the La Jolla Symphony when Sarah came and played his piano concerto in Kimberger II tuning.
which everyone knows.
Which everyone knows and is crazy. You can't tune to the A because the A440 is the single note that is most out of tune in the scale. And so the orchestra had to learn how to play and hear this. And so it's a fantastic way of getting people to encounter one of the most basic aspects of music making, and that is whether you're in tune or not.
And you're retuning your ears to a different perspective, too.
And how rich that sounds and how inviting that world is.
Well, Stephen, I encourage you to keep up your extraordinary work here in the Bay Area. It's always a pleasure to see you perform. The San Francisco Contemporary Players presents a full weekend of music by Lou Harrison and friends and some new composers as well. Tell us a little bit about Natasha Diels.
Natasha,
and The Colors Don't Match.
Natasha Diels is one of the most fascinating composers I know. She moved to San Diego recently from New York, and her music is both acoustically colorful, but also theatrically very, very persuasive. And so you get a sort of feast for both the ears and the eyes when you encounter Natasha Diels.
Music of Natasha Diels, The Colors Don't Match. Thanks for coming in, Stephen.
My great pleasure. Thanks, David.
From Natasha Deal's The Colors Don't Match, a 2014 work for voice, piccolo, clarinet, percussion, sampler, and violin, to be presented this weekend as part of the San Francisco Contemporary Music Players Celebration of the Music of Lou Harrison, 100th anniversary of. Information and tickets at sfcmp.org. And now, as they say, something completely different. Is a piece I grew up on from the Schlepptet in E-flat major to be presented as part of the San Francisco Chamber Orchestra's presentation of Music on the Lighter Side in San Francisco, Palo Alto, and Berkeley next weekend, April 28th to 30th. Full disclosure, I'm pleased to be a co-conspirator with Ben Simon for one of the works on that work. Ben, always a pleasure to welcome you back to our KLW studios.
Thank you, David, and we're looking forward to having you on stage with us.
Oh, indeed. Well, let's talk about the rest of the program that's going on and why you decided to do it in the first place.
Well, we've all had a tough year. I think we need a little comic relief, a little humor, a little time to relax and just sit back and chuckle. Funny is not an adjective you usually use for classical music, but there are some wonderful exceptions. And you grew up with P.D.Q. Bach, David, so did I. And I've been collecting funny pieces my entire life and finally had the nerve to put them on a San Francisco Chamber Orchestra main stage.
Well, for someone who's not familiar at all with P.D.Q. Bach, why don't you give us a little background on it?
Well, P.D.Q. Bach is an invention of the Peter Schickele, who is a composer and a musicologist. And he's the last and oddest of Johann Sebastian Bach's 20-odd children, and it really skewers all sorts of conventions in music history. He makes up instruments like the left-handed sewer flute and the slide music stand. His puns are wonderful. There is a movement in the Schlepptet called the Yehudi Minuetto. Of course, for classical musicians, this stuff is just rip-roaring funny. I'm assuming it's going to be funny for our audience as well. And we're starting with a piece by Schickele himself called The Unbegun Symphony, which, of course, is a take on Schubert's Unfinished Symphony. Schickele was born too late to start the piece, so it only consists of a last movement. And it contains not a single original theme in it. It's Bach and Mozart and Beethoven and Camptown Races. And
I hope you're offering a scorecard to see if everyone gets all of the references.
It's even difficult for me when I'm listening to this. He layers on these William Tell Overture with the Haffner Symphony, with Camptown Races. Is absolutely wonderful. And then, of course, the P.D.Q. Bach itself will be well represented. You are going to play two movements of the Sonata Piccola.
Ah, indeed, yes.
Which maybe you can tell the audience about.
I'll do that, yeah, okay.
Something with your the nose or the...
Yes. Apparently this was... It was developed in the Mediterranean when they used to, when the piccolo flutes were made out of pickle, actually. They used to brine them in a little olive oil and some garlic, and when they got to a certain size, they were ready to play. And, of course, people from all over the villages nearby and the Tuscan coast would participate, and it was the first ever Mediterranean flute fry.
Exactly. Boom.
Boom. We need a percussion. The percussionist left. Great.
Yes, Steve just like he was talking about alternate tunings. I think Petey Hubach actually beat Lou Harrison into alternate tunings for some of these instruments. Yeah. We're playing a movement of the Sonata for Viola, four hands and harpsichord. There are many piano pieces with four hands, meaning two players on one keyboard, but it's never been attempted before with the viola. We're doing his Schlepptet with that wonderful Presto Hey Nani Nanio that you just heard an excerpt from. And the big piece on the program, which you and Rick Malone from your rival public radio station will...
Nonsense. We're all friendly.
I know you are. I know.
They do a lot more classical than we do, that's for sure.
Will be New Horizons in Music Appreciation, and it's a take on Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, which I've always considered to be the ultimate Petey Hubach piece. The orchestra starts, and we have two sports announcers. And yup-up-up-a, and they're off with the four-note theme, and it just gets wackier from there.
We'll hear it in just a minute.
Fantastic,
but I want to give a little shout-out to KDFC's Rick Malone. Rick and I were co-presidents of the Brooklyn Heights Music Society back in the day, late 80s.
Fantastic.
He's a fine violist as well, and it's going to be so much fun working with him on this.
Are you practicing your viola jokes for the...
I've got a laundry list of them,
that's
for sure.
Good. Excellent.
And so the venues that you've chosen for these concerts in San Francisco is the...
The Herbst Theater.
Herbst Theater. Beautiful renovation that they've just done there.
It's lovely, yes. Mm-hmm.
And in Palo Alto?
We're at the First United Methodist Church on Hamilton. And because the First Congregational Church is still recovering from their fire, we're at the beautiful St. John's Presbyterian Church on Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock on College Avenue in Berkeley.
Very nice. Let's hear some of that New Horizons in Music Appreciation. This is a digital remaster on CD of the original LP called PDQ Bach on the Air with Professor Peter Schickele. I believe it was his first release. Is that not right? I'm not sure. From the radio station WOOF, Woof, at the University of Southern North Dakota at Hoople. And he's literally announcing from the barn. You'll hear... Barnyard sounds as he introduces this segment, New Horizons in Music Appreciation and Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, to be recreated by yours truly and Rick Malone under the baton of Maestro Ben Simon next weekend, thesfco.org. Let's listen to a little of that, shall we?
And now it's time for New Horizons in Music Appreciation. Different approaches to the problem of popularizing the 19th century classics. Now, unlike the Baroque masterworks, 19th century pieces such as the Beethoven symphonies are usually so long and melodramatic that the average listener has to be informed through the use of program notes as to what's going on in order to prevent him from falling into a confused slumber. The only trouble is that they always turn the lights down in concert halls, so you can't read the notes while the piece is being played. So, here is a new solution to a perennial problem.
Good evening, music fans. Here we are at Philharmonic Hall in New York Mills, Minnesota. It's a beautiful night for a concert. There's not a cloud in the ceiling. And there's quite a crowd out here. About how many do you think there are, Bob?
Oh, I don't know, Pete.
Well, neither do I, but it's quite a crowd. And I think they're looking forward to hearing the New York Mills Philharmonic playing against the Danish conductor, Heilige Dankesang. And here he comes now, ascending the podium. And the players are all lined up and ready to begin the first inning of Beethoven's Symphony No. 5 in C minor. Four-note theme. This is very exciting. The beginning of a symphony is always very exciting, folks. I don't know whether it's slow or fast yet because it keeps stopping. It doesn't seem to be able to get off the ground yet. And it looks like, yes, it looks like we're coming up to a cadence here, folks. The violins didn't cut off there. A little trouble with the violins. They weren't watching. And there's that four-note theme again, folks. And another stop. Just can't seem to get this piece off the ground. Now it seems to be rolling a little bit. Seems to be building up. Tell me, Bob, do you think you'd call that four-note idea a theme or a motif?
Well, Pete, the technical term would be motif, which he uses to build a theme.
I see. Thanks for setting me straight about that, Bob. Well, we're heading into the second theme section here, and we can expect a little modulation down there. Wow, did you hear that, Bob? Somebody down there in the horn section really flubbed that note. That was one of the worst fumbles I think I've ever witnessed in all my days. I think it was number one, wasn't it, Bob?
Yes, it was, Pete. That was Bobby Corno in the first chair, and that's the third major flub he's made this season, giving him a solo average for the season of approximately .247355, which is pretty darn low for a first chair man.
You think there's some chance he might be sold to another orchestra?
Well, it's hard to say, Pete. Corno's very good in the long solos, things like the
Peter Q. Bach's version of Beethoven's Symphony No. 5, First Movement, as a sportscast to be recreated with the San Francisco Chamber Orchestra. Yours truly, David LaTulipe, as co-sportscaster with KDFC's Rick Malone. Should be great fun. Ben and the rest of the program, amazing choices. Just to lighten up, people.
Lighten up. We're going to have a wonderful time. We hope you can join us and have a great time, too.
Thanks, Ben. I'm looking forward to our rehearsals coming up, too. Still to come here on Open Air, an interview with director Jonathan Cain about My Name is Rachel Corey, the internationally acclaimed drama based on the writings of 23-year-old activist Rachel Corey. And next, from the Cutting Ball Theater, we'll be talking with Ariel Kraft and founding artistic director Rob Melrose about the performances of Rob's translation of Phaedra at the Cutting Ball Theater. If I can find my notes for that, and I will be a happy fella. Yes, indeed. Cutting Ball closes its 18th season with genre scenes Phaedra, directed by producing associate artistic director Ariel Kraft. The story itself dates back to ancient Greece and remains the champion and gold standard for salacious and scandalous familial dysfunction, first staged in Paris in 1677. Ariel Kraft is a Bay Area director and arts administrator. In addition to her work at Cutting Ball, she is founding director of The Bread Box. Recent Bread Box directing credits include an acclaimed production of Martin McDonagh's The Pillow Man and radical reimaginings of Federico Garcia Lorca's Blood Wedding and John Ford's Tis Pity She's a Whore. In addition to work here at The Cutting Ball, she's worked with such companies as Impact Theater, the Custom Made Theater Company, Wiley West Productions, the San Francisco Olympians Festival, and other events. She was awarded an artistic fellowship at the American Conservatory Theater, ACT, following her graduation, and previously served as an assistant artistic director at the Custom Made Theater Company. Ariel, such a pleasure to welcome you to our studios. Of course. She is joined by Rob Melrose, longtime director of the Cutting Ball Theater. Rob, always a pleasure to welcome you back.
Great. Thanks to be back, David.
At our new digs here, huh?
Woohoo.
So fancy.
Well, let's talk about the translation process, shall
yeah.
we? It's one thing to translate a work from French, unless you're translated from the original Greek.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you make the transition to English and make it something that is not just a translation, but the subtleties of the language?
Absolutely. Well, it's a big challenge. Racine is kind of in this play. Phaedra is kind of the Hamlet of France, and it's the beautiful poetry and Racine's wonderful 12-beat line, the French Alexandrine, which are a series of rhyming couplets with two more beats than the Shakespearean iambic pentameter that we're used to.
Hmm.
And if you can read French, it's just gorgeous. And one of the challenges is, well, how in the world do we translate this? And different people have had different strategies. So Richard Wilbur, wonderful American poet, translated into iambic pentameter rhyming couplets, so like Shakespeare, but rhyming every line, and what a huge achievement. To my taste, that translation's a little sing-songy, and he, obviously you have to make huge sacrifices in the sense. And then Ted Hughes did a wonderful free verse translation, very, very but very winnowed down. And a similar strategy was taken by my mentor, Paul Schmidt, who translated Phaedra for the Wooster Group, who were just here at the Z Space, and he actually looked to film noir and kind of the quick language, the fast language of film noir. What I tried to do is I tried to do a free verse translation that has nice long lines that capture all the sense and all the poetry of Racine's verse. So you're not going to get the rhymes like in Wilbur, but I feel like you get the strategy I've employed is to try to give the audience as much of that of those long thoughts and those cut twists and turns.
Does this get to be a bit of a bit like the game of telephone, where we've been removed from the source material for so long, and we have this translation by this guy and this way of doing it? I imagine each translator is struggling to get the original out.
Oh, absolutely.
But also has to have a certain element of rewrite.
Yeah. So absolutely. I mean, and I've tried to get back to the original sense as much as possible, and I have a wonderful recording of it in French, and I listen to it again and again, and I try to get a sense of the rhythm and the energy of the line, and I try to get that in my own translation. But the thing I'm most proud of is sense wise. I tried to give the audience every metaphor, every poetic image that Racine gives. So it's actually very, very close to the original, which I'm excited about.
Talking with Rob Melrose, founding artistic director and co-founder of the Cutting Ball Theater, whose many translations include published translations of Wozzeck, Ubu Roy, and Pelléas and Mélisande have been published by Exit Press. Also talking with Ariel Kraft. Ariel, I'm wondering if you could give us a Cliff Notes version of what is happening in this classic Jean Racine play.
Sure, absolutely. So Phaedra is the story of a woman who's been left on this island with her stepson. Her husband is this great war hero, and he's gone off to do whatever he does when he's off traveling, being a war hero and a king. And she is left with this stepson who she has this attraction for, and she initially banished him to this island and then gets placed there when her husband leaves. And so she is here for 6 months with him, and this attraction to him keeps growing and growing as she is neglected and neglected by her husband. And the play opens 6 months into this captivity, basically, on this island, and she feels like she's going to die of this attraction for her stepson. And she's so ashamed, and she doesn't know what to do about it, and she says, okay, just let me die. And then in the first 10 minutes of the show, I don't think this is a spoiler, we find out that husband, or so we think, is dead, and that this changes the rules of the world, and that she can pursue her stepson. And essentially,
it's a stepson after all,
It's a step. A step doesn't count, right?
Exactly.
It's questionable. The morality of all of it is questionable. And basically, the play just moves from that axis and just unravels and becomes quite chaotic. Destruction, basically, everywhere is the result of one woman's desire, essentially.
Tell us about the cast you've assembled. It's a cast of...
It's a wonderful cast. We have a wonderful cast of 8 people, led by Courtney Walsh, who is playing Phaedra. She is just fantastic and nimble. And the thing that I love so much about this cast is that they are unafraid of the moral gray areas. And we've really tried to approach the work from a place of thinking compassionately about Phaedra as opposed to thinking of her as a monster, which is, Rob knows from doing the translation, they just call her a monster for the entire show, pretty much. Mm-hmm. The world is extremely condemning of Phaedra, and so our production, we've made an effort not to be in process and to think really critically about what this woman is going through, and specifically thinking about how it's a gendered experience. How there are double standards in the world of our play around sexuality for women and for men, and specifically how the paradigm of purity is so important to the female identity in this world and has nothing to do with the men, because her husband is just quite a philanderer, and everyone just talks about it like, yeah, that's what he does. And then she expresses an attraction, and the world literally crumbles.
Wow. I just cannot help but keep the commander-in-chief of our own country in mind out of my head. Now, did that enter at all into either of yours' minds as you're progressing through the artistic process?
Well, when I translated it, I thought Hillary was going to be our president. So,
well, she is. Technically, she is.
I didn't. So I had no idea about what was going to happen, because I finished before the election.
I mean, I think definitely thinking about sort of the regressive politics of our time, we were pulling aesthetics from the 1950s in Americana, and I think that though we don't have any specific Trump references, the idea that we have sort of – we've regressed back and we're looking at a period for women where it's this dangerous period where we're expected as women to be one thing is certainly something that has infused our production that we think about a lot. And thinking about for women expectations of when you see the show, you'll see – all the women have this constant baggage on them of how am I supposed to hold myself? How am I supposed to behave? What am I supposed to be doing? And then what happens when you misbehave? Hmm. And especially in a world that is extremely ready to punish.
And I was going to say that Ariel has done such a wonderful job with Courtney putting the focus on Phaedra. And, of course, this is, Rustine's neoclassical revision of Euripides' play Hippolytus, so it's Euripides' Greek play Hippolytus, but Racine, who's a contemporary of Moliere, rewrites it and puts the focus much more on Phaedra, and Ariel and Courtney have just done this wonderful job, and the way the set is, it's all pointed towards her, and it's laser focused on her, which is pretty awesome.
Rob, can we get an example of your translation? You have something in your head that you can offer us after all that work on it?
Oh my god! I bet Ariel's been in rehearsal.
Passing the buck. I don't know that I have anything off the top of my head, but I will say that Rob has done, as he said, an amazing job of keeping the sense in the language, and generally we've abandoned rhyme. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I find so delightful in the translation is that every once in a while he's found a way for the rhyme to come back. So as you're listening, there's these Easter eggs of lines that rhyme, and I think that will be a delight for people who come to.
So you get a little taste. You get a little taste of it, but without having to sacrifice the whole sense of play.
And I will say that yesterday I was walking through. We were getting ready for a final dress rehearsal. I was walking through some staging, and I butchered some of Rob's lines.
Oh, yes.
And I was thoroughly reprimanded by my assistant director. So I will not do it on the air today for fear of further reprimand.
What's your next project after this, Ariel?
After this, I hope this is an okay word to say on the radio. I'm doing a show called McBitch.
Nope.
Bleeping? Okay, yep. Great. We're doing a show called McBitch at the Breadbox. It is a compilation piece that we're building right now. It sort of sutures together Macbeth and Lord of the Flies and Heathers and cult movies like that. It is it's an original work with – we call it a collage Frankenplay because we're pulling from a bunch of Shakespeare texts. We also have new text, and it's generally it focuses around how women are conditioned to be competitive with one another and view success as a vertical ladder in which there's only room for one at the top, and sort of looking at how patriarchy is reinforced by the idea that women must – compete with one another, and how that's sort of insidious and a problem in modern feminism.
Hmm, interesting. So that's coming up.
Yep.
We'll have to have a talk with you about that. And Rob Melrose, The Cutting Ball is at the cutting edge, as always. What are you working on for next season?
Oh gosh! Well, we haven't announced yet.
Oh,
I can keep it as an Easter egg for later.
I can tell you,
I'm excited because I've taken this. Last year, I directed a dream play in Ondine, and I took a break from directing this year and translated Phaedra for Ariel. But I will be back directing, which I'm very excited about, and I'll be directing a Shakespeare play that I think most people listening have not ever seen. So how about that?
Very nice. Circling back to Phaedra, I'm just wondering if there, you know, the connection between Phaedra and Annie Lennox, how is this being worked in?
Annie Lennox? Am I missing something?
Is there some music involved in that, I guess?
No.
Oh, all right. I mean, we got the wrong reference.
Perhaps crossed wires, but...
Yeah, all right. I thought there was maybe...
But maybe you'll see it and you'll tell me.
Well, Phaedra is at the Cutting Ball Theater through the 21st of May with a soft opening on the 20th for some previews, right? Previews
today.
Begin tonight, right?
Yeah.
Right? Directed by Ariel Kraft, Rob Melrose as translator. Cuttingball.com for more information on that special translation production, and it sounds like it's a phenomenal event.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to catching it. Rob Melrose,
so
Ariel Kraft, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Of course.
Great to be here.
Bye.
Cuttingballtheater.com for more information about Phaedra. It's through the 21st of May. And next we're going to be talking a little bit on our, since this seems to be our theater half as opposed to musical half of the afternoon's open air, talking about Jonathan Cain in studio and about My Name is Rachel Corey. This New York production of My Name is Rachel Corey comes to San Francisco's Magic Theater for a limited run presented by Sawtooth Productions. It's created by journalist actor-director Alan Rickman and journalist Catherine Viner. The source material is from the 23-year-old Corey's journals, letters, and emails to family and friends, and follows her as she leaves her home in Olympia, Washington, to work as an activist in the heart of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Here to talk about the play is director Jonathan Cain, a native New Yorker who now splits his time between New York and Sun Valley, Idaho. In New York, he presented a revival of Mahbub Main's Obie Award-winning play, A Prelude to Death in Venice, and accompanied this with a concert version of Lee Breuer and Bob Telson's The Warrior Ant at the Puck Building in Soho. And in Sun Valley, he has directed more than 70 plays. Jonathan, welcome to Open Air.
David, thank you for having us. Having myself.
You're it.
I'm it.
So, my name is Rachel Corey. Tell us how these bits were assembled to make this through line story. What was chosen to make the theatrical arc?
Well, Alan Rickman, the actor who's best known for Harry Potter, The Guardian, the English newspaper, published Rachel's writings, and Alan Rickman was, as everybody else, was greatly impressed, took her journals and her emails to her parents, and approached Catherine Viner, who is now the editor of The Guardian, and they compiled it into this quite incredible play. The writing covers from about 15 to 23, and that's what attracted myself and my actress Charlotte Hemmings to it. Rachel was a quite extraordinary writer and a great loss.
And when did you first encounter this work?
Well, I've been working with Charlotte for a number of years. She's the daughter of English actor David Hemmings, who was in the iconic film Blow Up, which I'm sure a lot of people have seen. And I was looking for material for Charlotte, and somebody introduced me to the play. And I'm really all about great writing, and the writing was superlative. And Charlotte and I soon fell in love with it, and we've been working on it for about 5 or 6 years.
Wow. And what do we see on stage for this? It's a one-person show, right?
It's a one-person show. My designers are... great. They have all worked with Mahbub Main, the International Experimental Theater Company in New York. And Charlotte performs 80 minutes by herself, which is quite a feat.
No kidding, yeah. And how long has Charlotte been performing the role of Rachel?
For about 5 or 6 years. We've done readings in Sun Valley, and then we took it to New York City at Culture Project, had a tremendous reception there. And our lobby was filled every night with people discussing the play, which for artists is the greatest compliment.
Indeed. I guess there was a controversy back in 2006 about a New York production that was postponed indefinitely, but Alan Rickman called it censorship born out of fear. I'm also recalling the controversy at the Metropolitan Opera recently when there were intense protests surrounding John Adams and the death of Klinghoffer. How are things with this play some 11 years later?
Well, that part's interesting, too. We did it in New York, and we had no protests whatsoever. 10 years ago, when New York Theater Workshop tried to do it, it was canceled, and there was a great outcry among artists in New York. 21 Jewish playwrights signed a letter in protest, and I'm Jewish. My family is Jewish, very pro-Israel. They came to the show in New York. And everybody's kind of wondering what the controversy is about. And the play has been labeled by some people as anti-Semitic, and my family felt that nothing could be further from the truth.
Well, Rachel's parents are going to be present for after talks on May 3rd and 4th. Have they done this before?
They came out to Sun Valley. That's where we met them. They're wonderful people. Of course, they suffered an incredible tragedy. And getting to know them has been really a great, great experience, and we're excited that they're going to be doing the talkbacks on 3rd and 4th.
So we start off with Rachel discovering that she's heard about these things, she wants to go and be a part of change.
Right. Play is about peace. It's not about her death. She was an unbelievable idealist, and I think a lot of us when we were younger had the same sense of idealism that, why is the world the way it is? Why are we killing each other? Why are we at war? And Rachel wanted to help in any way she could. And she could have gone anywhere in the world. Mm. But she went to Palestine. And that's where her story took place. And it's her story. It's hard to refute it. It's what she experienced, she saw, she wrote. And quite amazing.
It's Jonathan Cain, director of My Name is Rachel Corey. It's running from April 27th. Through May 14th at the Fort Mason Center Magic Theater down on 2 Marina Boulevard. Can you talk to us about the music that's being used?
We have a collection of music. Rachel, there's mention of the Rolling Stones, and we have a kind of a rock score from that period. She was 23 in 2000, so that's pretty much the score of the show.
Hmm. Nice. Well, let's go out with one of the tunes that you've chosen to include, and you mentioned the Rolling Stones. Here's Ruby Tuesday. Jonathan, I wish you a terrific run from now through May 14th, and I'm looking forward to seeing the production myself.
Thank you, David.
Of course. Information at magictheater.org. My name is Rachel Corey.
If it's gone, while the sun is bright, or in the darkest night, no one knows. She comes and goes. Goodbye, Ruby Tuesday. Who could hang a name on you when you change? Question why she needs to be so free. She'll tell you it's the only way to be. She just can't be chained to a life where nothing's gained or nothing's lost. At such a cost.
Some Rolling Stones, some Pat Benatar also included in the soundtrack for the Magic Theater's production of My Name is Rachel Corey, being directed by Jonathan Cain. It's at the Fort Mason Center Magic Theater, 2 Marina Boulevard. For more information, visit Magic Theater, theatre.org for more information. Well, you know, I just can't resist offering a little bit more PDQ Bach to you folks tonight, this afternoon, and encouraging you to attend the San Francisco Chamber Orchestra performances of music on the lighter side, and on the extreme lighter side includes the Unbegun Symphony, as Ben Simon had mentioned, and it has movements 3, 4, and 5, or actually 3 and 4. This is from An Hysteric Return, PDQ Bach at Carnegie Hall.
Started doing concerts of the music of PDQ Bach, I managed to slip a little something of my own on. It was a piece called the Quodlibet. Working around PDQ Bach's music as long as I have, there's one trait of his which has rubbed off on me more than any other, and that is plagiarism. This Quodlibet was a piece which had not a single original theme in it. It was all quotes from other pieces. It was combinations of Beethoven's symphony with T for Two, and the piece was so successful, everybody went out whistling the tunes and everything, that I managed to persuade the producers of this concert to let me put on another one of my pieces, which I also wrote. And this piece is called the Unbegun Symphony. Now, you may notice on your program that it only has a third and a fourth movement. This is because I was born too late to get a chance to write the first two movements. So it is the Unbegun Symphony. Now, it used to be called the Pathetic Symphony. Now, these names, as you may know, like the Jupiter Symphony and the Eroica Symphony, are usually not given by the composer. They're given by friends or the musicians and stuff. And this name, the Pathetic Symphony, was given to my piece by some of my old friends. Well, I have a new set of friends now, and we're calling it the Unbegun Symphony. So I won't say anything about it except that be prepared to hear things that you've heard before. Well, let's let it go at that. Thank you.
Thank you.
the music geek in all of us, I think, loves that music, the Unbegun Symphony of P.D.Q. Bach, to be recreated by the San Francisco Chamber Orchestra under the baton of Ben Simon next weekend, next Friday, the 28th, at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco, 29th in Palo Alto, and in Berkeley on April 30th. Plus, the sports cast of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony with yours truly and KDFC's Rick Malone acting as co-sportscasters. Also, pick up my piccolo and begin a little bit of a sonata piccola for your entertainment. Information at thesfco.org. That's Open Air for this Thursday, April 20th, 2017. A pleasure being with you, and thanking Neil Swinkles for producing the show and herding the cattle and cats that come around these studios. If you have a segment suggestion or a group you'd like featured on Open Air, by all means, please send me an email, david@kalw.org. Our shows are archived at kalw.org as well. Thanks for listening.